with Clodagh O'Shea, who's in the Molecular and Cell Biology Laboratory at the Salk Institute, which is just down the street. We're actually at the Estancia La Jolla Hotel and Spa, but we're going to talk about the common cold virus disrupting cancer cells, amongst other things. Do you just want to set that up for me? Because this was a novel discovery that you folks made, and it has large implications. And I wonder if you could just set the stage for me and give me the context for this.
Yeah, sure. So my lab is really interested in coming up with new ways to treat cancer. So in the last 40 years, much of the work has been done at the Salk as well. We now have a genetic understanding of cancer. But that still has to be translated into really cures that work and actually result in permanent loss of the disease.
That's why the Salk's motto is where cures begin.
Exactly, right. And so a lot of this work, with Renato Del Becco and Tony, started at the Salk. And the reason it started there was, before when cancer genetics was in its infancy, when we really didn't, were only at the beginnings of DNA, people realized that actually viruses can give rise to cancer in non-permissive hosts. So that if you take an animal and infect it with a human adenovirus, it can lead to cancer.
Just tell us what an adenovirus is.
In its simplest form, if you want to think of a virus, it's a piece of malicious code. In this case, an adenovirus, the code is DNA. Okay, so it's a piece of DNA that encodes a set of proteins which literally take over the cell. And that piece of DNA is encoded, is encapsulated, kind of like a lunar module, by a protein coat. And that's what allows it to land on the cell, get in, invade. It then expresses its code, and it takes over the cell.
So when you're shaking hands with somebody who's got a cold, you're passing on lots of these little lunar modules.
Exactly, yeah. It's basically a space landing. It's basically a massive Mars attack that's going on.
Okay.
And what's, I think, fascinating about that is the adenovirus genome, the cold virus genome, it's 36 kb. Our genomes is 3.6 by 10 to the 9. And this tiny piece of code takes it over, right? So 9 proteins to rule the fate of 26,000. It's just fascinating, right? It hijacks the cell. And obviously to do that, it's incredibly clever. And when you have that minimal kind of a code, just like a computer virus can take over massive supercomputers, what it does is it hits the really key targets. It doesn't hit the peripheral targets. Like if you were to go into a company, it leaves the reception alone, but it goes straight to the CEO and takes it over from there. And that's very powerful then, because you can use the viral code and viral proteins to identify actually what are the key controllers of the cell. And that's basically what happened, is using viral proteins as a probe, a tool, they identified the key controllers of the cell, and it turns out that these same controllers, these same master proteins or hubs, are disrupted in cancer. And that makes sense, because if you think about what cancer is and what a virus is, at a very basic and abstract level, it's just uncontrolled replication. Mm-hmm. And there are only a number of ways that that can occur. And so cancer takes out the same master genes, the virus hits the same ones. And so basically, viral proteins equal tumor mutations in that sense. Mm-hmm. And so that's why it's such a powerful system. Then you can use the viral proteins to identify, well, what are the key targets that regulate cellular replication, cell growth, cell death. But there's also a really profound and exciting implication, which is, if viral proteins equal tumor mutations, could we make viruses then that no longer have this piece of malicious code, this viral protein which takes out the controller, so it can't replicate in normal cells. It can no longer drive the normal cell to replicate, unwittingly replicating the viral genome at the same time. Instead, it can go into cancer cells, though, and all the same controllers that the viral protein normally takes out are mutated. The cell is already going replicating. It's already lost its brakes. And so the virus, that mutant virus, could replicate selectively in tumor cells. And in that way, you can use the overlap between the cellular targets of tumor mutations and viral proteins to create viruses that selectively replicate and kill tumor cells.
So is this putting the brakes on?
Yeah, so there's two types of general mutations in cancer. One is an accelerator mutation, an oncogene, and one is a brake, a tumor suppressor gene. Mm-hmm. I guess what happened with the Prius is that you can be stepping down on the accelerator, but if you lose the brakes, if the brakes are on, it'll stop. So you have to get an accelerator mutation and lose the brakes, okay? A tumor mutation turns on the accelerator, and you have to delete the brakes. You have to get rid of them. A virus comes in, turns on the accelerator, and it literally actively takes out the brakes. And so the major problem in cancer therapy right now is the only drugs we have are against the accelerator mutations, because it is very difficult to understand or conceive, how do you target something that's lost, right? Mm-hmm. It's gone. You can't design a small molecule against it. Literally, the gene, the protein, it's gone. It's deleted from the genome of that cancer cell. And so the idea instead is that if a virus needs to get rid of the brakes in normal cells in order to replicate, make a virus that can't get rid of the brakes, doesn't replicate in normal cells, but tumor cells, the brakes are gone, deleted from the genome. And now the virus comes in, there's no brakes that can come screaming on to prevent replication, and now the virus replicates specifically there and kills the cell based on the loss of the brakes.
And then it proliferates?
Yes, yeah. It produces thousands of progeny, bursts the cell, which have the potential to seek out the surrounding tumor and even enter the bloodstream and go to distant micrometastases. That would fulfill many of the, I think, aspirations of cancer therapy.
Now, tell me about bringing to the story P53 at this mm-hmm. point, and explain what that is.
Yeah, so P53 is one of the cellular breaks I was just talking about. It's a gene that is literally an emergency break. It's turned on when the cell detects viruses, DNA damage, oncogenic mutations, and it comes on as a protective mechanism that we've evolved to stop the cell replicating, dividing more, or reproducing. In that way, it can stop a virus, it can stop a cell that has mutations, it can stop all of these different things. And the way it does it is it's what's called a transcription factor. Mm-hmm. And what a transcription factor is, it's kind of like it's like the read head of a disk. It reads the genes and pieces of code in our genome and turns on a program which effectively is the brakes, which stops the cell, just like it would an electronic car. It's basically the machinery under the hood, but that's the trigger, that's the button that you press. And in cancer, that every cancer has to get rid of the P53 brakes, by definition. It's literally almost the definition of what occurs in cancer, in the sense that if the brakes come on, you never get a cancer. So you have to get rid of the brakes. They have to lose it.
So it's get rid of the P53. We have to be out of control.
Yeah. Basically, you cannot get out of control as long as that is there. Okay? And the virus can't get out of control as long as P53 is there. Tumors acquire mutations. The virus encodes a protein within its genome to get rid of P53. So what you can do then is genetically engineer a virus that doesn't have that protein anymore, its own protein to get rid of P53, goes into a normal cell, P53 is turned on, stops viral replication. In a tumor cell, there's no brakes, it's gone, right? The tumor mm-hmm. cell has lost all of that, so it doesn't actually stop the virus replicating. And that lets the virus replicate, which eventually will kill that cell. And what's, I think, more exciting about that is it's not a gene therapy approach, in the sense that it actually reproduces. It's a replication competent virus, right? It really, it's not giving back a gene, it's not doing anything of that like that. It's replicating to reproduce itself specifically in the genetic environment that is particular to a tumor cell where the brakes are gone. And that, I think, is exciting, because even if we can only get a virus to 5% of the cells in a tumor, if we deliver it by the blood, if it reproduces logarithmically, producing 10 to 3 more viruses, now we have a local vaccine, live vaccine, an infection that reproduces itself right there and then, but can't spread because the brakes in the surrounding normal cells just come screaming on and stop it. And so that's a way of controlling it.
So do you have to have sort of some sort of bespoke tailoring going on? Do you have to, for each different kind of cancer, colon cancer, do you then create something which would be specific to that cancer?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So in terms of the reason we are excited about P53 as a breaks, RB as a breaks, is that those tumor mutations are changes occur in every cancer. So in that sense, that piece is a universal target, okay? It should take out literally all cancers, not a specific one. I think the challenge becomes, we need to get the virus to the cancer, okay? The best cure for cancer is a surgeon's knife, okay? If you can get rid of the cancer and excise it at that point, you're done, okay? The problem is you can't operate on some tumors, like brain cancers. Pancreatic cancer has progressed before we even know it's there. And it's difficult to get to certain tumors. So the virus, the common cold virus, and the one that has been worked on to date is called adenovirus 5 or cold virus 5. It infects the lung. I think it's a great virus for lung cancer, for example. Mm-hmm. But there are 54 human adenoviruses, and it's not because they all infect the lung. They actually have been found in different tissues. So I don't know what it is, how to make a colon-specific virus, because the environment is different, the immune system is different there, trying to target the tissues could be different there. But what we're trying to do is actually, again, get rid of the viral proteins that inactivate the breaks. Those are the same in all 54 of those viruses. But actually use what nature has already provided and evolved, in that we should use an adenovirus that infects the colon to try and treat colon cancer and use that genome, engineer those same mutations into a colon virus, the same for a virus that infects the kidney, for example. That those viruses have learned how to be there and adapted to that environment, and we could use that knowledge today if we can control their genomes. And we've come up with a new way of doing that.
Now, is this technique in actual use in patients?
So you mean the virus, the idea of viruses? Yeah, so I did my postdoc before joining the Salk as a faculty member. I did my postdoc at UCSF with Frank McCormick, who's head of the UCSF Cancer Center and is president of the AACR this year. And he was one of the founders of Onyx Pharmaceuticals, which came up with a prototype for these tumor-selective viruses. Are called oncolytic viruses, is how they're often referred to.
What does that mean?
It means onco for the part of the cancer, and lytic is that they are replication competent viruses. It distinguishes them from just trying to deliver a gene. So it's basically a virus that undergoes tumor selective replication because the breaks are missing or other mutations are there. That's what is often referred to in the literature. When I arrived in Frank's lab, I'm an immunologist. I did my PhD in immunology. The clinical trials, the phase two clinical trials were going on. And it was shown to be safe with promising clinical activity. And in 2005, this became the first agent to be approved. So it was bought by Sunway Pharmaceuticals and now is being used in patients in China. What I was interested in is, well, it's the immune system that stops viruses, right? Mm-hmm. So what's the balance there? How do we understand whether we want to activate the immune system? Because a live vaccine replicating a tumor could also reawaken our immune systems that a tumor is there and may have a beneficial effect of targeting metastases that are very, very distant, okay? Or would we want to suppress the immune system because the virus will replicate better? Mm-hmm. And that's how I came to be involved in it. And I came there to do that experiment. That's the experiment we still want to do today. But at the time, what was happening in patients is it was working, but not for the reasons people thought. It turns out, and this is what we discovered here, that there was another viral protein that no one knew about that was able to turn off the brakes by a completely novel way. And so it replicated specifically in tumor cells for other reasons, but it wasn't because of the P53 mutation, which would be much more desirable. And since I came to the Salk, that's what we've discovered what that viral protein is and how it works. And that now enables us to make a virus that is truly will engage the brakes and will only replicate in tumor cells that have lost.
When I look at the diagrams that go with papers and so on, it all looks to me immensely complicated.
Yeah.
And as you just said, you start thinking to yourself, well, is there just one thing happening here, or there are several things, and we've only found two of them?
Uh-huh.
And it's a very complex issue, it seems to me.
It is. It's what's amazing about it, and I think this is I think it's probably one of the most profound challenges in contemporary biology, is that we can understand individual pieces, which is the classic reductionist approach, but how do we understand how they act together as a system, right? And I guess I draw inspiration from the fact that when we really didn't understand DNA, restriction enzymes, oncogenes, tumor suppressors, it was a simple thought, which is this tiny virus, which I can control and infect, can give me cancer. Therefore, what it's targeting can teach me how this incredibly complex disease occurs, right? Mm-hmm. If the individual targets are the same, then I'd suggest to you that the entire program could be the same, because that's what the virus is. It's a program.
Mm-hmm.
So just as viral proteins were used to identify individual targets, I think the viral infection, the entire code, is a wonderful system, simple at a genomic level, that can be manipulated to understand the whole system, what's redundant, what's not. If you take this away, is there another way of doing that?
Yeah.
Well, now, with that system, we can understand it because it's something that we can add. We can study it dynamically. We have real control over it. And we can actually say, how does it take over the cell? If you get rid of this, does it still manage to work? If so, why? What's that target? And in that way, map actually not just the kind of key hubs, kind of like the World Wide Web, what the key hubs are, but actually how they're connected. It's kind of like cancer in some ways, and why it's so difficult to treat. It's like an airline problem where if you wanted to stop United Airlines working, if you take out JFK, you can still get to any other part in the country by rerouting via Dulles or something else. If you took out Dulles, JFK, and Chicago, suddenly now the system is broken. It can't recover.
Right.
And that's what we need to understand. We understand right now what the individual points are, but they can all speak to each other, bypass each other. The virus understands that too. It maps them, right? That's how even the World Wide Web was mapped, actually. It's the only way.
Mm.
So can we use it to understand the hubs and how they're connected, and actually how we can break it? If we can stop viral replication, which has evolved over thousands of years to be fast, does in a day what it can take 40 years in a cancer cell to occur. If we can stop that, I think we can stop cancer. And I think we can identify the key targets that do it, using it as a probe and as an entire system.
Hmm. When did you have this idea that led to this work?
So as I said, I really was looking at the immunological problem, and that's, I heard actually Frank speak when I was a PhD student at ICRF in London, and I remember him talking about this idea, and it was just so elegant, so simple, so intellectually compelling, is that the virus does the same as cancer, therefore you can make a virus that doesn't kill cancer. That was his idea. But as I started working on it, and exactly what you're saying is that it was more complex than that, I suddenly realized, wow, there is a lot more to be discovered about these viruses and their viral proteins and how they work. And actually that it's a very powerful system, more powerful than ever actually, to understand all of the genomic data that we're getting, right? Because we've got thousands of genes, we've got lists right now. But how are we gonna filter them, right?
Mm.
How are we gonna put them back together? If you think about what the cold virus is, in its very abstract form, it's really a 36 gene expression and delivery vehicle, right?
Mm.
We don't know how to express 36 genes, right? And we certainly don't know how to deliver them. If we could do that, we could have whole pathways. We could take over a cell. If we can understand the principles of design, of how that works, can we use it to create new synthetic systems, express whole drug pathways? actually take that genomic data now and put it back together, because we can use it as a vehicle. So we need to understand its proteins, how its genome architecture is so efficient. Splicing was discovered there. It's a master of delivery. Then I think we can really begin to use it. And I think that kind of merger between virology, cancer, cell biology, that they're one, fields have tended to separate, so that you don't tend to get the virologists as much more talking to the cancer biologists, talking to the physicists, talking to the systems biologists. Mm-hmm. But more than ever, I think that's important, because it joins all of these things together, actually. And that's actually one of the reasons I decided to join the Salk faculty, because it gave me that breadth and opportunity to interact with colleagues who know about each of these individual pieces and how they're connected.
So let's go over the trajectory. I've seen something where you were asked some questions about how you got into this business, but let's do it for here as well. Did you have parents, teachers? Was it a book? What turned you onto science in the first place? I mean, and where did you grow up?
So from my name and accent, you can probably, and the speed at which I speak, but. I grew up in Cork, Ireland. Yeah. So I was born there, raised there. I'm the first of my family to finish university and college. Ireland at the time, it was going through a transition, certainly, but it was, I went to an Ursuline convent school, which was quite strict, lots of nuns and things like that, and quite rigid. We didn't actually have science till I think the equivalent of 13 years of age here. Was a lot of language, more classics. And I love to read. It allowed me to explore the world and all around it in a kind of more open way, and ideas that were not necessarily being discussed at the time. And in some ways, I guess I found the atmosphere somewhat oppressive, in that there tended to be an idea that there's a right and there's a wrong answer, and nothing in between. Mm-hmm. Right? And in fact, that you shouldn't ask questions, really, because I guess I was always curious. I'm like, well, how do you know this from the Bible? Or actually, that really doesn't make sense with that other piece. I was learning, but that was not appreciated. And I think what really drew me to science is that it is, your job is to ask questions. In fact, it's the power you're basically enabled, driven. You have to ask questions that no one has ever asked before, and there are no answers. Mm-hmm. And I found that tremendously exciting. And so I think I had a microscope when I was 10. I just wanted to be able to see things at, you know, a deeper level and get deeper answers to where we are, how have we come to be, and find the scientific truth behind all of those things. How do black holes work? And so I just loved science. It was that exploration, that discovery that reaches beyond your four walls and beyond a more kind of a strict schooling system, and to believe that there are things to be discovered that no one has seen, and that science gives you the knowledge, the tools, and the ability, the method to do that.
OOP53, license to explore.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, I actually loved a lot of different topics, but it was quite funny, I used to be called Spock in school, because I tend to be quite logical. It's like, well, you know, there's nothing emotional. It's like, it's this or it's that. And so in that sense, it's like, well, the data says this, so let's forget it. And so my parents, which is actually unusual, actually begged me not to become a medical doctor unless I was basically going to become a coroner, because I had the bedside manner that might only work with dead bodies. And so I thought, well, yeah. Since I didn't become a doctor, because I thought, a practicing medical doctor, because I thought, I could see that these treatments weren't working, that people didn't understand why they didn't work, and it was like, well, it does or it doesn't, and that doesn't satisfy me. I want to understand why it doesn't work, how we can make it better. You know, the thought of treating a cancer patient where I know 60% are going to die statistically, I just couldn't live with that. I wanted to make it better. That felt like my particular contribution could be, as opposed to my personality per se. And so I decided to do biochemistry, since it's kind of understanding biology in the simpler language of chemistry and the physical sciences. Mm-hmm. And then I realized after my bachelor's, I don't actually remember even making the choice. I was told where to apply. And I knew that I wanted to, science for me is a hobby, really. It's a passion. I do it for free, but don't tell the sulk. But it's I wanted to help some other people, and so I wanted to do something that could be translated or has an impact on disease, and that's why I chose to do my PhD in immunology at a cancer center, because I felt the immune system is our body's defense against all kinds of diseases and invaders, and that is relevant for everything, actually any kind of a pathological situation.
So you went from University College Cork. Yeah. And then you went to the Imperial Cancer Research
mm-hmm. Fund in London, which is
in the center of London.
Lincoln's Inn Fields, yeah.
Which Paul Nurse used to run.
That's right, yeah. Was head of the cancer center at the time, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. And then to UC San Francisco.
That's right, yeah. Okay. With a trip to Africa in between, actually. I actually went on an expedition there for a while.
Well, it does seem to say, in pieces I read about you, you do seem to have a lot of exploring genes. There's a picture of you here at the peaks of Cerro Torre during an ice climbing trip to the Patagonia region of South America prior to starting your cancer research at the Salt.
Yeah, I took it.
So you're a big traveler?
I love to explore the world and different cultures and kind of the most remote places and the adventure. I guess in that sense I'm a bit of an adrenaline junkie. There was things besides science that interest me, and so I wanted to explore Africa for a year before I started my postdoc and go to Patagonia and climb and do all of these things before starting my lab, because you need big chunks of time for, I think, really immersing yourself and learning and exploring new cultures, new areas, new terrains.
Yeah. Not that you're particularly old, but I mean, you've done enough now to be mm-hmm. in a position to be able to give advice to a young scientist, which is the title of Peter Medawar's little old book, as you recall. I mean, what would you say to the people coming through under your tutelage at this point?
I think be passionate. Above all, do it because you want to know the answer. It doesn't matter if your supervisor, if the funding agency will fund you to do it. If you don't want to know the answer, if it fundamentally, at the beginning, doesn't have the potential to change the world, don't start lower than that, right? Because you'll end up lower still, right? But be passionate. Remember why you did it, right? To ask questions that maybe some people even find uncomfortable or don't believe you, right? Those are probably the questions that are the most important to ask that can change the world.
Yeah. There's been a couple of articles, and there was one in the New York Times, I think, this morning, or another one a few days ago, about women in science. Mm-hmm. And I just came back a few weeks ago from the Women's Economic Forum in Deauville, where I was running a panel on these sorts of things. And whenever I get a woman scientist there, I say, should I retire this question? Is it more difficult for you, or was it more difficult for you, or not? And to a woman, they say, no, keep asking the question, because yes, it is more difficult. Mm-hmm. Even though you're in this wonderful place right now, yeah. I mean, what's your sense about that?
I think I've been very lucky. I'm Irish, after all, but I think a lot of what faced women in science before, they paved the way. And it's made it certainly, I think, a lot easier for me and actually my peer group today. It's still probably different in the sense that there are different challenges, I think, for women, even in terms of how they portray or tell their science. There's maybe less testosterone involved in general, and so, which is not a lack of conviction or makes it any less true. It's just, it's a different style, and you know, but both are valid and actually very important. And so, It's funny. I was raised in, I was educated in an all-girls school. And I do wonder now if that made a difference, because you're not competing with males. You know, it's you gain confidence speaking. You know, that's in some ways somewhat secluded from them. But you develop very much your own personality and as an entity and individual as yourself without that distraction or that intrusion. And so it has definitely, I think, colored my approach, my interactions with people, because I haven't felt any difference or that there's anything less or more, but that it's equal. And so in approaching the world like that, and my interactions with my male and female colleagues, I guess I'm gender blind, and sometimes that translates to people being gender blind in return. And that can help.
Role of science in society. My administration will restore science to its rightful place.
Yeah.
Which is what?
So, I think science is knowledge. Science is knowledge and exploration. And more than ever, I think that has a really important role in our society and world. I think when we lose science, that questioning, that ability, the Dark Ages descended, and it was its rediscovery that reignited the Renaissance and even where we are today. The tendency, I think, right now, or if I was to read into President Obama's comment, is there's a tendency to either beatify or demonize science, right? Science is above all of that. It's simply truth and knowledge, right? It's not, it doesn't pick sides. And how man uses it is how man uses it. The truth is the truth. And I think that, like the National Academy and science itself, its rightful role is to provide knowledge. How that is used is not, you know, as a scientist or as an entity, a philosophy. That's a different matter, but it's the search for truth, whether it serves to improve our existence, I hope so, but knowledge for knowledge's sake, that is very important, and it is that, and I don't understand how anyone can either disagree or, you know, create a hedonistic piece around it. It's exploration, and sometimes I think in terms of what science we should be doing, we should be asking the questions that we don't know the answer to. We may want the cure to cancer, but we may not know what the right question is yet or where that knowledge will come from. And so it's very important to have both basic and applied science, but also just that joy of discovery, that will to explore, and not to step into the political fray and use it as a weapon. Or otherwise, it's the pursuit of knowledge and the scientific method, and that in itself is wholly positive. You can't take knowledge away, you can only reveal truth and the deeper layers that lie beneath.
You never consider doing anything else in science, then, are you not?
There's many things I considered, in fact. I love adventuring, so I certainly consider the oceans and things like that, and maybe becoming kind of more zoologist, but I like to write, actually, and I love poetry. I like to argue, so I consider law. I really enjoy literature as well, and so.
Yes, I mentioned to you that a lot of your papers have got sort of word plays in them. DNA tumor viruses, the spies who lice us. I mean.
That's just, I get bored with the very rigid language. It indulges that other side.
So who are your favorite poets then? What's your?
I have to say I love Keats. I adore Keats. I think Yeats, for his lyricism and I think the profound beauty of the music that he creates with words is wonderful. I think as well that Emily Dickinson, for that staccato, almost rhythmic style and that wraps on your consciousness, is fantastic. And Milton, for all of his puritanical style, it's just the most incredible, I think, poetry. I find that very uplifting.
Mm. So, if I gave you a time travel token, it doesn't have to be a poet, and said to you, you can bring anybody to your dinner table, mm-hmm. any discipline, any time in history, right. Is there anybody that you would really love to have a conversation with and ask some questions of?
Yes, there are so many people, but I have to say, I'd love to know who Shakespeare was. Was it a woman? Was it a man? Who was that?
And there was a movie out about that right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, no, there is. I mean, it's been debated, but I mean, he was one of the greatest anatomists, I think, of the human condition that is so relevant today. What a mind, and then wrapped it in this extraordinary language. With his devilish wit, wonderful characterization, and these insights, right? Kind of part psychiatrist, psychologist, writer, you know, historian. I mean, fascinating. I would, and also cloaked satire, irony, science, prodded society along certain paths by almost parodying it. I think whoever that is would have been fascinating.
Mm. Do you have any sort of sense of where you would love your research to go? Is this sort of any grand ambition in your plot of your future universe?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I would love to have an impact on cancer. That's probably my deepest and dearest desire, and you know. It's sort of discouraged to say, oh, you can't say you want to cure cancer, but you know what? Frankly, I do. I think it's, again, aim high, because if I can have an impact and help, I think that would be great. Is there a silver bullet or a virus of the silver bullet? Probably not, but I think they could have a profound role to play. It's a totally different kind of a drug. It could be used together with different drugs, and it's just a new combination, and it's a natural combination. In ways, cancer is a sophisticated disease, and I think we need something as sophisticated as the disease itself to treat and overcome it. Viruses have that potential, simple and yet, you know, sort of devastatingly clever and succinct. They're kind of the, you know, the Porsches, that sleek machine that, you know, if we could understand how they work, would be great. And I think the ultimate test of that is, if we can create a virus, if we can truly predict a priori how it works, what it will do, a real genetic nanomachine, I think I will understand what a virus is. Mm. Because when you create, that's the ultimate test of understanding, is to create, predict the outcome, control it, and then use all of that knowledge to do some good. Mm. And I think cancer is my ultimate goal. But I think, as I said, in its abstraction, to be able to deliver genes or create new pathways and systems also adds, I think, to a lot of other fields. And that's why I think exploring that for both the neurosciences and in general, synthetic systems is very interesting and exciting. But cancer's the goal. I'll stick to that for the moment. Ask me another 5 years, I may have lowered my ambition, but I'm young and I have enough energy to still think that we can have a shot at it.
Mm. How did you get to the Salk anyway in the first place?
How did I get there? Yeah, so I was at UCSF and I was looking for faculty positions. And I was considering several different options. And I think what drew me to the Salk was the energy. Somebody said my fiance when I got out of the car after coming back from it, because I had been interviewing at various places, is that I had found my lost tribe. And that's what it felt like, where, you know, there was all of these people who, you know, thought great general thoughts and explored and knew both the history and could predict the future and were creating the new paradigms. Tony Hunter, who discovered tyrosine phosphorylation, the first oncogenes, as the head of the department. It was, you know, these were legends.
Yeah. Inder Verma.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Inder, you know, the father of gene therapy, you know, found all the pathways, was basically messing with viruses when I pretty much hadn't even been born. I just thought, wow, You know, I got to be there. I have to try. I mean, you know, this is incredible. And the really interesting thing is it's a place where they were not saying, can you get funded to do this? They were saying, why is it important? What are you going to do that makes a difference? And that appealed to the very reasons back as a child, back in school, why I did and why I love science is to do that. Not, it's not a job, it's not to get funded and get the grant. That's important, that's part of it. But it's to answer the questions people haven't even dreamed of, to find answers that, you know, could have an enormous impact. And I felt that here. I felt among a peer group who actually live and have answered those questions.
Final question, what are you optimistic about?
What am I optimistic about? I'm really excited right now about taking this, all this genetic information in terms of cancer and actually really turning that into new therapies, into something that actually isn't just telling a patient what mutations they have, but saying, and we can treat it with this. I am optimistic that we can do that as a field, as a society. We're close, and it will take an interdisciplinary approach. It's going to take, we haven't done it yet, there are no right answers. It's going to take some leaps, but it feels as if, with this new computational power, it feels like we can do it. I believe we can do it. I'm an optimist in that sense, so that's what we're shooting for.
Right. Well, I wish you well on your journey, and it was great to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Great. Thanks. Bye. Bye.